So we've covered now this whole subject about how to cultivate a proper reliance on our teacher. And this is the meditation, this is a meditation subject for doing analytic meditation. You know, previously we went through and we discussed all the prayers and visualization. We got it to the point, just like we did before we started the talk, where Shakyamuni was on top of our head and we said the mantra. Now at this point, in your meditation sessions, you would now do analytic meditation on this. Okay, in other words, all the different things, this being the first one, and the different subjects we're going to go into, are the actual topics upon which we meditate. Okay, so what you would do, you get to the, after doing your prayers, the Buddha's on your head, then you have your notes in front of you, or just even this outline, if you know the points pretty thoroughly, and don't need too much explanation. And then you do this analytic or thinking, contemplative meditation, where you're actually thinking about the different points to gain an understanding and to gain an experience in your heart. So the thinking that you do is not necessarily intellectual blah blah thinking. You're not thinking about the advantages of the teacher and disadvantages and how to rely on the teacher, like it's some abstract thing up there. But you really think about it in terms of your life and your teachers. Yeah? And really think about it in a very heartfelt way. And this is what you might call Buddhist therapy. Okay? You talk to yourself. You become your own therapist, or your Buddha nature becomes your therapist. These teachings are your therapist. Okay, they're giving you something to reflect on so that you can sit and reflect in a very orderly manner about different points that are going to help you understand yourself better. And, you know, just as when you do any kind of introspective work, you know, when you get some clarification, there's definitely an experience in your heart. It's not dry words and intellect. So similarly, as you, you know, think your way through these things, different feelings arise and experiences come that definitely influence you. And when you get a very strong feeling, when you feel like you've really understood a certain point, then you stop at that point and you do the stabilizing meditation or the one-pointed meditation. Okay? So for example, you might meditate on this first thing, the examples of properly relying on a teacher. And you go through each point step by step. You know, you read one and then sit and think about it. And read a second one, then sit and think about it. Sometimes you may think about it for a minute. Sometimes you may hit a point that might really, you know, there's so much to think about, you might be there for half an hour. Okay? But you really stay on each point and you know, go down them. And then when you get, by the time you've gotten to the end of the eight advantages, some kind of feeling is probably arising in you about, wow, this is a really beneficial thing if I do this, and I really want to do this, and something is happening inside. And so at that point, you do the stabilizing or single-pointed meditation, and you hold your attention on that point. And you just experience that feeling, let it soak into you. Okay. And then you go on to the, you know, to the subsequent points. Okay. And also sometimes when you're doing this analytic meditation, you may come to something, you know, and you'll read over your notes and you'll start thinking about it and you'll go, this is like mud. I don't really get this at all. Okay? So at that point, you know, if you're not getting something, if it's just like not appearing clear to you at all, try and at least formulate your question. Try and at least understand what isn't clear to you. And then you can go back to your teacher and say, I don't get this point. Yeah, I was thinking like da 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 da, and somehow I'm just, it's like civil war inside and I'm not getting it. Yeah. And so then you ask for your teacher's aid. Okay? So you go through the different points and, you know, really think and contemplate about them. And it really does change you when you do it. It really changes your mind. It really clarifies your mind and gives you more energy for your practice. So, we've talked about how to cultivate a proper relationship with our teacher. Having done that, okay, then we go on to the actual way of training our mind, okay? Because we cultivate a good relationship with our teacher so that we can learn the teachings and benefit from that. Having done that, then we go on to the other steps, okay? And it's at this point that we're going to start the next point in the outline, okay? But before we do that, I just want to, because we're at the end of a section, stop and open it up for questions so that, you know, we can discuss what we've covered so far here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in one session, do you go through all of the points of, let's say, this meditation? That depends on how long your meditation session is, how concentrated you are, the rate at which you're meditating. In other words, you might do only the eight advantages during a session, or you might do the eight advantages and the eight disadvantages, or you might go through the whole thing. It's kind of is depending on your own internal rhythm and your own feeling. Okay? So if one day you only get as far as the eight advantages, then the next day or the next meditation, go on to the eight disadvantages. Review the eight advantages and then go on to the new one. Or if you feel like, you know, there's still more in the eight advantages that you want to go through, you can go back through them and do that again too. Okay? But what we're going to try and do now is, you know, learn all the steps of meditation in the gradual path and gain some familiarity with all of them. So it's good to kind of move on from one subject to the next, but always reviewing the previous subject. Okay? So it's hard to say how far you're going to get. Okay? And then in your break time, in other words, after you've dedicated for that meditation session and you've gotten up, try, and by the way, one thing I find that it's really good, right before you dedicate, summarize your meditation. You know, kind of just summarize it so that you are really clear about this is what I've gotten out of this session. And then after you dedicate and you're going around doing all your other things, try and really bear that understanding in mind to keep it alive. So you can, you know, try and remember what you meditated on in the morning throughout the day and just bear it in mind as time goes on so that that understanding remains with you. And eventually, as you become very familiar with all these different meditations and the steps on the path, then it becomes like a very handy toolkit, because then so many things that circumstances and situations that you encounter, you're very quickly able to tune into exactly the right meditation, you know, and it becomes quite powerful. Also, what does happen sometimes is you might be sitting and, you know, really thinking about all these things, and you might get stuck at a certain point, and then sometime at a later date, something might happen in your life, or somebody might say something to you or something, and all of a sudden it's like something clicks. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's exactly what this meditation was about, you know? Or some very strong, you know, something happens in your life and you remember one of these points that you've meditated, and it's like some very strong feeling comes in your mind because you're really capable at that moment in your daily life of really seeing the connection between the Dharma and your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so how do you balance meditation practice with service? So this is a really vast topic, you know, and I think it's going to vary a lot from individual to individual. Because I think some people are like really happy to offer service, because when we have a lot of restless energy, then even we sit down and try and meditate, our knees hurt, our back hurts. Even they don't hurt, our mind can't concentrate, and we're like just, the mind is like bubbling water. So I think many people realize that, and so they still have a lot of faith and commitment to the teachings, and so then they like to do something that's more active, yeah, because that enables them to put their Dharma understanding and their faith and commitment into daily practice, because it's difficult for them to sit still. And that's very, very effective for them. And they really prefer to do things that way. And I think especially when people are quite young, you know, you have a lot of energy and, you know, it's nice to have service-oriented things to put your energy into and to also help you mature as a human being. Okay? Now, if I think it also commands some wisdom in the situation, because as you pointed out, some people go so much for service that they get completely burnt out. Or you're so busy offering service that you have no time to meditate, and so you wind up getting angry at the people that you're working with in offering service. Yeah? So at that point, I think you really have to set off your own internal burglar alarm. Okay? And when you're going too much on the side of service so that you're neglecting your meditation, so that then you're becoming difficult to live with and agitated and angry and dissatisfied, then that's really a signal of, hold on, you know, I really need to realign and do, you know, take more time and space for myself and do more silent meditation. And so at that point, if you feel like you've gotten so involved in service things, then you need to either work it out with the other people you're working with to give you more free time, or go to your teacher and say, can you replace me with somebody else, because my mind's completely bananas right now. Yeah. So I don't think it's wise to let ourselves get burnt out. Sometimes we do. I think one of my most important teachings was when I got burnt out, because I learned I should not let this happen again. Yeah? And my teacher could have said, talked all he wanted about balance, 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 but it wasn't until I got myself so exhausted that I couldn't move that I actually understood that it's okay to say no. You know, that I'm not necessarily selfish when I say no, but I have to really keep myself on my feet, because otherwise I can't help anybody. Yeah? So, you know, sometimes you get to that point of burnout, but then you learn from it, and it becomes a very powerful lesson that you couldn't have learned otherwise. Through lots of words, you had to have, you know, gone to it, fallen into it yourself. And if you're the kind of person that is really attracted by meditation, and that's what you really want to do, and you check with your teacher, and your teacher says, yeah, go for it, then do it. No problem. Yeah? So I suspect that's probably what Genlo's done. Yeah? Now, if you're, you know, if you want to meditate because you can't stand being around other people, and when you offer service, it means working with all these obnoxious people, then, you know, it's like, okay. Yeah? I mean, I do need my meditation to get myself together, but I can't run away from things. I really have to put my meditation into practice. And so then you see offering service as an extension of your meditation. So it's the two-way thing. When you're also, some people fall into the extreme of doing a lot of service because they want to avoid meditation. Not just because offering service is a good way of doing their stuff, but because they really don't want to meditate. And so at that point, again, you know, under the, your teacher might help you, you know, balance again. Or if you realize that, you might ask for a little bit help from outside to put you into a little bit more disciplined situations where you're meditating more.
Feeling sense of backing away from the content.
So is the stabilizing meditation necessarily non-conceptual?
No, it's not necessarily non-conceptual. It can be either. Okay? In other words, sometimes you might really focus on the feeling aspect of it a lot. Sometimes the feeling and the conclusion you reach in your meditation are completely together. You know, like maybe you're meditating on the precious human life and you come to this really strong feeling of, I want to make my life meaningful. And the words, I want to make my life meaningful, are completely mixed together with the feeling of, I want to make my life meaningful. So you hold on to the whole thing. It doesn't mean you keep reciting those words to yourself, but, you know, you hold on to that whole thing. Okay? But at that time when you're doing the one-pointed meditation, you're not sitting there thinking and saying words. Okay, whatever conclusion, because a conclusion can be a concept, you know, you hold on to that single-pointedly. If your feeling starts to fade, if the intensity of that conclusion just blah, then you go back to more thinking and analysis to reinvigorate it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does it mean that we wouldn't recognize Shakyamuni if we encountered him? Because that form of the Buddha's mind, you know, appearing at the time of Shakyamuni, was a very special form. It's called the Nirmana Kaya, or the emanation body. And to perceive the Buddha as the emanation body, okay, in other words, to see all the special signs and physical marks on his body, it isn't just a question of having an eye organ and an eye consciousness. We need a lot of good karma to perceive it, because the things we see are very much our karmic vision. Yeah, the purer our karma is, the more we can see. The more obscured our mind is because of negativities, then the more things appear depressed, uncomfortable, and dull. Okay? So if our own minds are obscured, then even Shakyamuni came in here with a body of golden light, with 32 signs and 80 marks, you know, and wheels on the palms of his hands and all these things, we wouldn't see them. Yeah, because of our own mental obscuration. And it just, just to show you how our mind works, I mean, even we all sit and talk about Milarepa. This is this great Tibetan meditator in the, when was it, 12th century, 11th, 12th century. And he, you know, like had killed all these people. He felt tremendous regret. He went and studied with Marpa. He put up all this hardship. And then he went and meditated, and he was so dedicated to his practice that there was no food around, so he just ate nettles. And it was freezing cold, and he meditated, and he attained enlightenment. You know? And, you know, we sit and say, wow, Milarepa is so wonderful. But if Milarepa walked in this door, you know, we would probably tell him to get out because he was dirty and he had matted hair and he didn't have shoes and what?
He was green.
Yeah. And he had bad breath and he didn't brush his teeth and, yeah. So, I mean, just, you know, and people even say that about Jesus, you know, especially all the parents who don't like their kids to have long hair, you know, that Jesus were their son, they would probably kick him out of the house for having long hair. So, I mean, this just has a lot to do with our own way of thinking, you know, that we don't always perceive other people's qualities, even though they have those qualities from their side.
Other beings besides people in the world being our teachers?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right. It doesn't, your teachers don't have to be monks and nuns. They can also be lay people. You know, there's many excellent lay teachers. Yeah. And just this, I didn't let you finish your question.
Well, I was thinking about all beings.
Sure, exactly. And I think this is, you know, really part of developing a more flexible mind is when we really tune into all the circumstances that life presents us with. you know, so that we can learn something from every person we encounter, from every situation we experience. I remember when I was first, I had just come back from my first meditation course, you know, completely glowing, the Dharma's so wonderful, and I'm really going to try and practice. And I stopped somewhere in town to get some donuts at a bakery. And when I was going back to the car, there was one homeless person kind of leaning up against the wall, looking kind of spaced out. And I thought, I'm going to be this incredible bodhisattva and give him a donut. Yeah? So I took one of my prize donuts out and I gave it to him. And he said, look, I'm putting the teachings into practice. And he stood there and he held the donut. And then he just crumbled it in his hand. And it all fell all over the parking lot. You know, this donut that I had just paid good money for. You know, is now crumbs on the, and he didn't think twice about this. And all of a sudden I thought, I mean, this was an incredible lesson for me. Yeah? I mean, I haven't forgotten it 16 years later. Yeah? This was an incredible thing to learn from this person. Yeah? About my own expectations. You know, about what does it really mean to help somebody. So I think many times there's so many situations in life that every day can be like this for us.
Mm-hmm. Here we are, a karma situation, we're not alive.
Okay. Well, if we were alive at the time of the Buddha, we probably wouldn't still be hanging around doing what we are now. You know, because the disciples at the time of the Buddha...
Huh? I said, well, that's a real goal.
Well, you know, I mean, we have accomplished something. We have our limitations, but we have accomplished something. But the disciples at the time of the Buddha, you know, I mean, when you read the sutras, it's like they're gaining realizations right, left, and center. Yeah, because they have incredible accumulation of positive karma from previous lives. So, you know, even like the Buddha's five first disciples, yeah, And they were all swearing at him and saying they're not going to talk to him when he first came up to teach, and somehow his whole presence magnetized them. He gave this teaching, and at the end, you know, they were all well along the path, and one of them had even gained realization. Yeah? And so there's all these teachings in the scriptures about people getting very quick realizations because they've done a lot of work beforehand. Yeah, and so probably if we were born at the time of Buddha, we would have been that kind of person, and we wouldn't be hanging around now. Actually, you know, when they talk about Maitreya Buddha, the next wheel-turning Buddha, in other words, the next one is going to give the teaching and start it after, you know, this present age, what we're doing now is creating the cause so that we can be born as Maitreya students and gain quick realizations then. Okay? But at the time of Shakyamuni, maybe he was, you know, there in India, but maybe we were born in, you know, some other universe, in some other life form. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or we could have been a cow on the road, you know, as the Buddha walked by, and our mind stream got blessed, you know, by us being a cow and seeing the Buddha, you know, and then that kind of elaborated on through more lifetime. Actually, I think we're going to stop here for tonight. So let's do a little bit of digestion meditation now. Let everything sink in. Try and remember the points so that you can hold on to them and continue to contemplate them later on.